Dr. Fuller, what shall the United States do to ensure a continuing supply of rubber?
There are four possible answers to this question. First, the possibility of expanding synthetic rubber production in our country. Second, the possibility of developing plants which will grow in the climatic conditions of the United States. Third, the possibility of stockpiling imported rubber. And fourth, the possibility of expanding cultivation of rubber trees in tropical America.
This is the story of Science and People, a story told by two men, Lou Audrieth, who conducts this weekly conversation, and his guest for today, Dr. Harry J. Fuller, professor of botany. Listen to their story of rubber. Now, Lou Audrieth.
Well, we don't want to take up the question of what to do about our domestic supply of rubber right at the very beginning, because there are some other things that we want to talk about first, Dr. Fuller. I think all of us remember, of course, the war days and tire rationing, and we also recognize the fact that rubber is an extremely vital material so far as our manufacturing production in this country is concerned, and also so far as national defense is concerned. And we recognize furthermore that the Jap conquest of the rubber-producing areas out in the Pacific made it very essential and vital that new sources of rubber be developed. Well, today, Dr. Fuller, we want to ask you a few questions in your capacity as an economic botanist and learn something about rubber, the way it grows and the way it's processed, and in other words, get a story on the whole subject itself. I understand that rubber is an American product, Dr. Fuller. Is that so?
Yes. The principal sources of rubber are Native American trees. The product of rubber was exploited by Native Indians of the Americas before the discovery of America. And when Columbus and those European explorers who immediately followed him landed on the shores of tropical America, they found that rubber was in use.
Well, when was it actually introduced into Europe, Dr. Fuller?
It was introduced into Europe in 1735 as a kind of scientific curiosity without any expectation that it would ever develop into a material of vast economic use.
Well, I understand that the old Indian name for rubber and the older name for rubber is actually caoutchouc. Who introduced the name, the modern name for it, Dr. Fuller?
Our present name, rubber, for this product was used first by the great English chemist Joseph Priestley, who observed in studying its qualities that it would rub or erase marks from paper. And since it rubbed the marks out, he applied the term rubber to it.
Well, that's rather interesting because Priestley is, of course, the discoverer of oxygen and was actually banished from England somewhere around 1775 or 1780. And came to this country and settled in Pennsylvania. I've actually visited his home at Northumberland, Pennsylvania, Dr. Fuller, and so that fact that he's the actual inventor of the name rubber is a very interesting one to me as a chemist. Well, now, when were the modern uses for rubber actually developed, Dr. Fuller?
I think we may say that the modern utilization of rubber as an important product began with the work of McIntosh in 1827, who perfected a moderately satisfactory method of applying surface coatings of rubber to fabrics. You may remember that we still use his name to apply to a certain kind of raincoat. Then in 1839, Goodyear, Charles Goodyear in our country developed a process which we call vulcanization of rubber. This process corrected some of the earlier difficulties in the utilization of rubber. McIntosh's rubberized fabric, for example, became stiff and brittle and cracked at temperatures slightly below freezing, became very sticky and tacky at midsummer temperatures.
Well, then the vulcanization process actually is the beginning of the modern rubber manufacturing industry, is it not, Dr. Fuller?
Yes, that's correct. Vulcanization resulted in what we might call the stabilizing of the physical properties of rubber over a wide temperature range, from temperatures well below the freezing point of water to temperatures above those of our midsummer days.
Well, now, how much rubber is actually used for various purposes? Do you have any statistics, Dr. Fuller?
Statistics since the beginning of the war are rather unreliable. In the last relatively normal year before the war, 1939, the total rubber production in the world was somewhat in excess of 800,000 tons.
Now, where did most of that natural rubber come from, Dr. Fuller?
More than 90% of this total production of natural rubber came from countries in the southeastern corner of Asia and certain adjacent islands.
Well, that's rather interesting, Dr. Fuller. You stated earlier in our discussion that rubber is sort of an American product, that it was first discovered in the Western Hemisphere. How come that it's now, or that it was grown and developed to a much larger extent in other portions of the world, whereas our American production may have lapsed?
One of the reasons which accounts for this is the fact that the natural wild rubber producing areas of the Americas, principally the Amazon basin of Brazil, are very remote from centers of population. Inhabitants in these areas are few. They're principally very primitive nomadic Indians. Therefore, it has always been difficult to secure enough labor to tap the trees in this area.
Well, now, in order to make up for a deficiency which arose when the Japs conquered, let's say, the portions of Asia where the rubber is now produced, it was necessary for you to go down to the South American, Central American, look over some of these rubber sources, these potential sources. Can you tell us something about the types and kinds of plants and trees that produce rubber that are found in the Americas, Dr. Fuller?
Yes, there are at least 12 or 13 species or kinds of trees which are natives of tropical America which produce rubber in their tissues. Of these, only two or three produce rubber in sufficient quantities or of a satisfactory quality to warrant their commercial exploitation.
Well, what are these varieties, Dr. Fuller?
The major one is a tree known as the Para rubber tree. That's spelled P-A-R-A, incidentally, and is from the name of an important Brazilian city at the mouth of the Amazon. It is sometimes called Brazil rubber tree.
Well, there are certain procedures which are employed in getting the rubber out of the tree itself. Can you just briefly indicate what the methods of processing the material consist of?
The rubber in a rubber tree is present in a special kind of sap, a milky sap, which we call latex. This sap is present principally in the bark in special conducting tubes, and these tubes must be cut in order to release the latex which they contain. This is done in a process which we call tapping, which is done in various ways depending upon the species of tree being tapped.
You say this white sap or latex, is that something like the sap in the dandelion or the milkweed that we recognize as part of the sap of plants that grow in our part of the country?
Yes, the milky juice which you find if you cut off a dandelion plant or a milkweed is a kind of latex. And interestingly, the latex in both these plants contains rubber. If you don't believe that, take a couple of drops of the latex, rub them between your fingers, and you'll very quickly work up a few strands of rubber.
Well, now, after all, we can't use the latex directly. How is that converted into a crude material that can then be sent to this country or brought to this country for processing as crude rubber?
The old method used by the Indians to harden or coagulate the rubber from the latex was to dip a wooden paddle into the latex, dipping repeatedly and turning the paddle over the fire, the smoke from which hardened the latex. At the present time, however, most of the coagulation of rubber is accomplished by a chemical method, namely the addition of formic or acetic acid to the latex as it comes from the tree.
But I understand, Dr. Fuller, that you still have to smoke the latex or smoke this coagulated material after it has been processed by chemical means. Why do you have to smoke a rubber?
There are two reasons for doing this. One is that the warm smoke in a smokehouse ascending over the recently coagulated sheets of rubber dries them out completely. The second reason is that the smoke imparts to the sheets of rubber hanging in the smokehouse certain organic materials which have a kind of preservative action and which discourage or prevent the growth of molds, mildews, bacteria, and other organisms of destruction on the sheets of rubber while they're in transit.
Well, now you've discussed the Brazilian or Pará type of rubber. Is that any different in its composition or different in the form which is obtained in nature from the Panama type of rubber that you've also indicated as an important American source?
Yes, the Panama rubber tree, which is a native principally of Central America, produces a kind of rubber which in its elasticity and certain other characteristics resembles Pará rubber. but which contains certain resinous materials and other chemical agents not found in the Pará rubber. The presence of these extraneous substances means that Panama rubber has to be subjected to certain extra cleaning processes at the factory, and thus it's more difficult to handle in the Pará rubber.
Well, now, Dr. Fuller, we have these two tropical types of rubber. I understand that during the war, a considerable amount of effort was expended by our United States Department of Agriculture in possibly making use of materials which can be grown in this country. Can you tell us something about these local potential sources of rubber which can be grown, let's say, in certain portions of the United States?
Yes, there are actually several kinds of plants which will grow within the borders of the United States and which contain some rubber. Several of these have been investigated intensively by scientists in the U.S. Department of Agriculture and in some of the universities, but virtually all of them have been rejected except one. That's a shrub called guayule, and that's spelled, if you're interested, G-U-A-Y-U-L-E. This shrub is a native of semi-arid regions of northern Mexico and the extreme southwestern part of the United States, parts of Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas, for example. During the war, and even preceding the war, attempts were made to grow this shrub in parts of eastern California and central California and Arizona, cultivation which was expanded by our government when the rubber shortage descended upon us in 1942.
Well, now you say this material is somewhat different from the form in which the rubber is obtained. Can you, let's say, expand on that point a little bit? In other words, is there a latex in this guayule plant that you speak of, or how is the rubber actually present and how is it obtained from the guayule plant?
Guayule contains no latex. The particles of rubber are present in the tissues of the plant in the form of very small microscopic particles. Since there is no latex, there is no way of having these rubber particles flow out from the plant. Thus, the plants must be uprooted and subjected to a process of grinding or maceration, as we call it, which results in tearing them apart completely. The tiny particles of rubber then float out in water and are skimmed off the top.
Well, I see. That's very interesting. Now, there are some other types of rubber or terms used in connection with rubber. For instance, gutta percha and balata. How do those differ from the, or how are they similar from the rubber products that we obtain, let's say, from the Pará and the Panama-type trees and from guayule?
Gutta percha and balata are produced in the latex of certain species of plants. They bear a certain superficial resemblance to rubber, but they are not elastic. They're pliable and somewhat soft. They can be twisted, but they don't stretch.
Well, now, if they're not elastic, what are they used for, then?
They're used for a number of important purposes. Insulation for cables, particularly undersea cables, because these substances are very resistant to salt water. They're also used in the manufacture of the surface layers of golf balls and machine belting, certain surgical instruments, temporary fillings for dental work, and a number of other minor uses.
Well, there's just one other question that I want to ask you here in connection with the type of rubber. You mentioned that the Indians actually chewed rubber. Was that where our modern habit of chewing gum was developed? Is that another American custom, let's say, that goes way back to the aboriginal inhabitants of the Western Hemisphere?
Yes, contrary to the conviction of most American school teachers, the imps in the grades did not actually invent the chewing of gum. This goes back to the aboriginal Indians of the Americas.
Now, I'd like to ask you this one question again that we started off our discussion. What should we in the United States do with respect to our rubber supply? Now, you've mentioned some of the sources of rubber. What recommendations would you give to our listeners here with respect to ensuring our domestic supply of rubber?
I think in the first place we should stockpile a considerable amount of rubber by importing it from the world's principal rubber-producing areas, namely Southeastern Asia. Second, I think we need to do some more experimental work on guayule because we really don't know its ultimate potentialities in rubber production. Third, we ought to carry on and continue our synthetic rubber program because synthetic rubber has certain specific uses for which natural rubber is not suitable. And last, as military insurance and also as a gesture of international goodwill in Latin American relations, we ought to do something to promote and expand rubber cultivation as a crop plant rather than a wild plant product in tropical America.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Fuller, for this very interesting discussion about rubber. I'm sure that all of us can profit from the knowledge that work such as you are doing will help ensure an adequate supply of rubber for the future.
Next week, Lou Audrith will have as his guest Dr. Severina Nelson, director of the University Speech Clinic, with another story of Science and People, presented by the University of Illinois Radio Service.